Day two of the NRL 22 championships, this week on Mail Call Mondays. I'm John McQuay with 8541 Tactical, and this is Mail Call Mondays, the show that answers your questions about precision rifles, optics, and equipment. Welcome to another Mail Call Mondays, and this Monday we are going to cover day two of the NRL 22 championships. This was the second part of a two-day match. If you did not see part one, make sure you go back and check that out, and we will drop a link to that, a little call out above and down in the comments section. That way you guys can go check it out and see what it was I was shooting. I did shoot a Tika T1X in an MDT chassis, and I did a full rundown on the gun there. I did not shoot this rifle in front of me. We'll talk about this shortly. But we are going to go ahead and just jump into it with the first stage for day two. Day two started a little bit earlier because we didn't really seem to have to worry about fog. So we got in, everybody got their gear out pretty quickly. We were rolling out. And again, I was on squad seven. So on the second half, we had 10 stages to shoot out of the 20-stage match. We started on stage 17. Stage 17 was titled Keep It On Four Tires. It is a 120-second time limit, and round count is 12. Ranges and targets are beer bottle targets at 107 yards, 145 yards, 178 yards, and it was 10 points per impact. The equipment is any equipment the shooter uses must be carried to the firing position. Start position is standing, rifle in hand, magazine in, and bolt open. The description is, on start signal, shooter will engage the beer bottle at 107 yards with three rounds from the tire laying down. Shooter will then move to the first standing tire and engage the beer bottle at 145 yards with three rounds. Shooter will then move to the next standing target and engage the beer bottle at 178 yards with three rounds. And then shooter will move to the suspended tire and engage all three bottles with one round each. So on this one, you had a couple of things going on. First of all, the tires were in various different positions, so you had to build a position on each. You had to manage your dope, and since you were firing multiple shots at a single target, generally dialing was the best way to get to it. So dial your dope on before you start for the first target. Once you get on that first target, you engage it, three shots, move to the next, three shots, move to the next, three shots, and then the last one shot on each. So that gives you 12 rounds total. Now these tires were a little bit tricky. They were in various different orientations, down, kind of sideways to you, then end on, and then suspended. And so each one of those positions required a little bit different setup on the gun. I pretty much chose to rely on the Game Changer for most of the positions. I thought that was going to be the steadiest, and then filling in with the pump pillow. But what I found as I got onto the higher tires is I really was not getting stable. At first, they were kind of leaning back towards you. So I tried to get on and pull the tire back in to stabilize it because it did move quite a bit. That really wasn't working out well. So then I figured out when you actually loaded into the tire, because it was angled towards you, you could load in and press down and get a little bit more stable. But the wobble area was pretty ugly. The targets were not very large. So that, you know, shaky wobble area didn't really help. Because of the way the tire was leaning back towards you, the one that was sideways to me, free recoiling didn't really work well because there was still a lot of up and down bobbing on it. So it was fairly difficult. I believe I timed out before I got to the last tire, so I didn't get to shoot the suspended tires. I came off of it with 50 points out of the total 120 points available. So that was pretty ugly. But it was what it was. Some guys were able to work through it fairly quickly. I think in this instance, lighter gun probably worked out. The Tika is a fairly heavy setup, so it worked in quite a few situations. It just didn't work in that one. So fairly straightforward, fairly easy to run. After that, we moved on to stage 18, which was the Hostage KYL. Now, this was a really interesting setup. I wish I could have got closer to take a picture of the actual rack that we were shooting on. But to describe it to you, it is a Hostage KYL rack. So it would have heads of varying different sizes on the rack. And then right next to that head, it had a cutout piece of steel that was a partial exposure head. So they were two separate pieces of swingers, two separate pieces of steel, but one was the hostage, and then the partial was the hostage taker that you had to engage. So the time limit on this was 120 seconds. The round count was 10. Ranges and targets are the hostage KYL rack at 100 yards. The threat was pink. The hostage was white. And then you had a bell at 200 yards. The points were 10 points per impact. The equipment was any equipment the shooter uses must be carried to the firing position. Start position is standing, rifle in hand, magazine in, and bolt open. On the start signal, shooter will engage the threat targets at 100 yards from large to small. If the shooter hits a hostage, the shooter must shoot and hit the bell at 200 yards to begin the second run. As soon as the shooter hits all the threat targets on the first run, they must hit the bell at 200 yards and then begin the next run. On the second run, if a shooter hits a hostage target, the shooter will stop and keep accumulated points. If the shooter hits all the threat targets on the second run, they will engage the bell at 200 yards with one shot, hit or miss. If the shooter fires 10 rounds, the shooter is finished and will keep all accumulated points. So again, two things going on. You had a 100-yard rack and then a 200-yard bell. If you missed or if you hit, if you hit a hostage, you had to shoot the bell. It didn't say anything about if you missed, just if you hit a hostage, you had to go shoot the bell and you had to hit the bell before you could come back to the targets. So on this one, I came off of it with 70 points. There really wasn't any wind for it, thankfully, but I got psyched out when I got to the smallest of the target and held a little bit too safely and missed. I was able to get the bell, held center, missed, held right edge, missed, and then held center again and hit. So there was something strange going on with the wind for the bell. I did have two failures to feed on that, which ate up a little time. And unfortunately, when you have a failure on the gun, it's difficult because now you're pulled out of the shooting problem. You have to go into the mechanical fixing the gun problem, and then you have to get back into it, make sure the wind hasn't changed, make sure everything's still good, and then get your shot off. So a lot of guys really, really got psyched out because as you got down into these smaller, really fractional head targets, it got pretty difficult. Again, you had to pay attention. The wind, we were getting this early in the morning, so wind wasn't too bad yet, but we were shooting across a little bit of a valley, so you had the ability to catch some wind, and on the little ones, if you caught some wind and you didn't account for it, you could very easily either hit a hostage or miss the target. So thankfully, I didn't hit any hostages. I did get one miss, but then picked up the miss. So it was a really fun stage overall. It was prone, so it really was not that difficult as far as positions. It was just bipod and rear bag. And then after that, it was just having a game plan and sticking to it. Because you were mainly staying at the plate rack, I dialed for the plate rack. If I recall right, I did dial when I went up to the bell and then came back to engage the plate rack again, but I didn't need to have a second run on the plate rack because I ended up out of ammo before I was able to engage any more on the plate rack. So that was Hostage KYL. We then move over to stage 19, which was titled Trailer Trash. The time limit for Trailer Trash was 120 seconds and a 10-round count. Ranges and targets were a 2-inch plate at 80 yards, 3-inch plate at 100 yards, 4-inch plate at 125 yards, and a 5-inch plate at 150 yards. It was 10 points per impact, and the equipment was any equipment the shooter used must be carrying to the firing position. Start position is standing at the back of the trailer gate, rifle grounded on the trailer, magazine in, and the bolt open. The barricade that you're shooting off of was 4 tires stacked at the front of the trailer. On the start signal, the shooter will move onto the trailer and engage the 2-inch target with 1 round. Shooter will then ground the rifle, remove 1 tire from the trailer, and engage the 2-inch and 3-inch targets with 1 round each. Shooter will ground the rifle, remove 1 tire from the trailer, and then engage the 2-inch, 3-inch, and 4-inch targets with 1 round each. Shooter will then ground the rifle, remove 1 tire from the trailer, and engage the 2-inch, 3-inch, 4-inch, and 5-inch targets with 1 round each. Young guns, they did allow a little bit of help for the young guns because these are rather large tires that you were throwing. So if a young gun was not able to move the tire, they just had to ground the rifle. Someone else could move the tire and they would have to rebuild their position after that. I chose to run bipod extended and use the game changer as a front support. So the bipod wasn't actually there for shooting support. I wanted the bipod extended because you had to ground the rifle before you moved the tire. Even though it was possible to hold the rifle in one hand and just one arm the tires off, the rules specifically said ground the rifle, and they did call one guy earlier for not grounding the rifle. So they were very clear on that. Rifle had to be set on the ground, and the bipod extended meant I didn't have to spend a lot of time setting the rifle down. I could set it down pretty quickly. I wasn't worried about it rolling over, banging turrets, banging the scope, falling off the trailer, anything like that. So that was fairly easy. Because we were going between different targets at different distances and the position was not super steady, I chose to keep my turret zeroed out and just hold for the different yard lines. That tended to be what most shooters did because you had to fight two different instabilities. The trailer had some movement on it because of the suspension of the trailer. And then the tire stack, as it got higher, even your weight on the gun would move the tire stack. So you had to put a little bit on the gun to be able to get the elevation to where you needed. I did go with the fore end because of the angle of the trailer. The bag under the fore end worked fine. And then the buttstock almost on the back of the tire. That seemed to be the best position to be able to get it done. I came off with 60 points. I held elevation, but I timed out before the end. I was trying to go as quickly as I could and not really jiggle everything, but as I went back and I looked at the video, it definitely looked like I was moving way slower than I should have. That's where I eat up a good amount of my time. I don't recall how many shots I had left. I know I timed out before I got to the last tire. So it seems I was getting good hits until I timed out. So that kind of hurt me there. In these kind of instances, you need to slow down to break the shot. When you're not actually on the scope, you need to be moving as quickly as humanly possible. And I didn't waste a lot of time moving the tires. I would generally just hook underneath and flip the tire off. In fact, I almost hit Neil with one of the tires. He was kind enough to sit off to the side and videotape me, but as I flung one of the tires, it went straight for him. So thankfully it didn't hit him, and he was still able to get good video of me shooting the stage. But just getting the rifle back up and getting into position, it looked like I was burning way, way too much time. So that was trailer trash. Let me move on to stage 20. Stage 20 was unknown distance. This was 120 seconds, round count was 10, and the ranges and targets were two AC zone IPSC targets and three 50% IPSC targets. You had 10 points per impact. The equipment was any equipment the shooter used must be carrying to the firing position, although they said no tripod on this. I'm not sure why you would use a tripod, but they specifically said no tripod. The start position was standing, rifle in hand, magazine in, and bolt open. On start signal, the shooter will find and engage all five targets with two rounds each from near to far. Now, this was a little bit of a change because when we were handed the stage descriptions, the description originally said they will find and range all five targets. In what actually ended up happening is they gave out the target distances, the target dimensions well before you shot the stage, and it was kind of an honor system that you could figure everything out, but then once you shot, you weren't allowed to give any of the rest of the squad information. Now, this normally wouldn't be a big deal in a PRS-type match because you really don't want to give anybody else tips that would help them beat you in the match. Everybody kind of wanted to figure out their own stuff, but we have seen before in PRS matches when you have sponsored teams up there, generally they will send a dummy up first to shoot it and see if the math was on and see if the ranges were correct. And then at the end of it, everybody in the squad had the info because people are texting the info back and forth. So I didn't see any of that go on this one. Thankfully, everybody seemed to be doing pretty good. Now, our entire squad worked together to make sure everyone had the ranges before we started shooting it. So again, that was nice to see because people that hadn't actually ranged targets before, they got a quick crash course in how to do it. And we were pretty much dead on with our estimates. Now, shooters could not use any electronic range-finding equipment. You could use calculators, you could use formulas, spreadsheets, that kind of stuff. You just could not use a laser rangefinder. So really no optical stuff other than spotting scope or rifle scope. And they did allow you to get on glass beforehand. Shooter needs to call out their targets before engaging to help the spotter. So our squad had a little bit of an advantage on this, I think, because one of the guys had brought out a Razor spotter with the mill eyepiece in it, and that thing was just really crystal clear. I was really able to, standing up without any mirage in the way with the spotter on a tripod, I was able to look, and well before our squad was getting ready to shoot, I could mill out each one of the targets out there. And then with the information the RO gave us as far as the height on the targets, I was able to very quickly plug it in and figure out what the distances to the targets were. The formula that I have always used is height in inches times 27.77 divided by mils. Now you have to be fairly precise on this. Mils, you have got to go down into tenths and sometimes half of tenths of the mil to be able to actually use this formula accurately. It has to be 27.77. If you start rounding lower and lower, you start to really cause some issues with errors in the formula. But it's a really easy formula to use, gives you your distance to the target in yards. So it's something that I've pretty much always used. And what we ended up coming up with is we had a target at 105 yards, 114 yards, 126 yards, 149 yards, and 189 yards. Now, the difficulty on this one was you had to engage near to far, and it ended up actually being pretty much of a zigzag pattern. So right, left, center. was the order that you had to engage the targets from. Now, two rounds per impact, or two shots per target. And on this, we did start to get a little bit of wind. So you did have to go ahead and make a wind call. Now, because you had two shots on each one of the targets, what you generally heard, and when you see my run on it, I would get on the target, I'd check my wind, I'd send the shot. As soon as I got the impact on the target, because these targets were large enough and they weren't quite beat up enough yet, we could see impacts on them. If I spotted my impact, as soon as I got my impact, I was sending the next shot. So you see bang, bang, just right away. And then I'd move to the next one, pause for a second, send it, bang, bang, and hit it. And then next one, next one, next one. So we got all the way out to the last target, the farthest target, fired my shot, got my hit, bolted up the next one, sent the next one. And for some reason, it's way out there. It's got a flasher on it. I didn't hear the hit. I didn't see the flash either. I thought I had missed. But they called an impact on it, and I was happy. I stood up on that one and actually cleaned the unknown distance stage. So, again, I was happy with it. All of our shooters that used our data did very well on it. Nobody really had any great difficulties on it. This one was another one where having my dope card on the side of the gun was really nice. Because I even drew a little zigzag on it, pointing to the next target to tell me what order I needed to engage the targets in. And it worked out great. It was, again, a really enjoyable one because you threw in a skill that a lot of people do not practice. And it was probably the first time a lot of people had actually had to go through and use that formula or use a formula and calculate your dope. Now, one little bit of a technical tip on this is that the targets, their longest dimension, because they're IPSC silhouettes, their longest dimension is height. So when we milled them, we milled the height and used the height to calculate the range. So you always want to get the largest dimension of the target and use the largest dimension of the target. So that is just some tips to use if you ever go out and try it, but it's kind of fun at the range. Just write the formula down, height in inches times 27.77 divided by mils, and that will knock it out. You can do it pen and paper, you can do it a calculator, or there are a couple of apps for the iPhone and, of course, Android as well that allow you just to plug the figures in and get your range really quickly. The next stage after that was stage 11, which was loophole. And loophole was 120 seconds. Round count was 12. Ranges to the targets are 10% IPSC at 48 yards, 50% IPSC targets at 179 yards, 220 yards, and 227 yards. 10 points per impact. Any equipment the shooter uses must be carried to the firing position. Start position with standing, rifle in hand, magazine in, bolt open. On the start signal, shooter will move to the sawhorse and engage all four IPSC targets through the loopholes with three rounds. This one was a very challenging stage for a lot of shooters. So there was a sheet of plywood with various different holes cut in it, and then there was a sawhorse set behind the board. And then, of course, you had your targets at range out there. All of the targets in the array could not be engaged from any single hole. So you had to pick your hole very carefully, and then you had to make sure that you accounted for the mechanical offset of your rifle. Many shooters went up there. They could see the target clearly through the scope, and they would put 3, 4, 5 shots into the wood of the board because while you could see through, the bullet did not have a clear unobstructed path, and it would clip the plywood or hit the board pretty solidly and then not go through. And we're shooting rim fires here. So it is not like shooting a center fire where when you hit the board, you'll take a large chunk out of it and the next round has enough room to go through. These you could stack rounds into them and you could see the bottom edges of the holes just chewed up from previous shooters shooting them. So the 100-yard or the 48-yard target was very close and at a very hard downward angle, and then the other targets kind of stretched off to the side. So when I went up to shoot, I started on the extreme right edge of the sawhorse, and I had to get really, I actually misjudged to begin with, and I had to move over a little bit to select the hole that was tall enough, because it was basically two hole saws cut through the board, so it was kind of an oblong port. I had to select one that was low enough and angled enough so that I could get on that close end target. I still ended up clipping the board a couple of times on it. So I got my first three shots on the 48 target, but for that, I was using the extreme top of the loophole. In fact, when I looked through it, I had a plywood colored blur that I was sighting through and put the crosshair about where I believed that the upper edge of the target was. I could only see the bottom edge of the target clearly. So my crosshair was actually aiming through plywood. And because the height over bore problem here, the bullets were able to pass through. So I was able to get all three shots on the 48-yard target. When I moved out to the 179-yard target, for whatever reason, I just really could not get on. So I ended up wasting all my shots on that one, and I actually ended out timing out before I finished the stage. So I only came off with my first three shots, so that was 30 points for me. I timed out on target three. Now, for this one, really height on the barricade was really critical. So the gun setup I used was the Backbone and the pint size game changer and the pump pillow. At the start, I wasn't prepared. You needed two magazines for this. I have one loaded magazine in my carrier. I have failed to load my second magazine from the previous stage, so I had an unloaded magazine. So I got kind of rattled at the start. Had to run back, grab some ammo, stuff it in the mag real quick, and then come back up and be ready to run. If I was running a high capacity magazine, 15-round mag, 12-round mag, something, I would have been able to get through it with one. But I had to plan for a mag change in there somewhere. So that may have rattled me a little bit. But honestly, I think there was something else that was getting me on this. Either wind was getting me or just a horrible position. But even after I was able to actually see the target and locate the target, which was very difficult and ate up a ton of time, I wasn't able to get my hits on the longer targets. So a lot of shooters went up and they had too much elevation to hit the first target. It put them too high and they just weren't able to see the target. And then they'd strip out whatever their support was and go just forend on the sawhorse, and that put them too low. And then they could see the target just fine, but they were chewing the bottom out of the loophole. I don't really like loophole stages. They're extremely challenging, but this one was done fairly safely. What I recommend is if you are setting this up or you are doing this at home, then something that can eat bullets without sending frag back at you is a good option to do. They did a good job with the plywood here because we didn't get any frag back, any spall or any splinters or any of that. But when you do these for practice, do something like a couple of layers of cardboard or something of that nature, something that you are not going to get stuff to come back. You want to be really careful with anything that's metal, anything that's concrete. So just a word of caution on setting up loophole stages at home. A really easy way to do it at home is just cut a hole in the cardboard and then mark any shots on the cardboard. So you fire a string of fire, you can go up and you can very easily see if you punch through the cardboard. The drawback with doing it with cardboard is you, depending on the range of the target, you can punch through cardboard and still hit the target and score an impact. So you have to be honest with yourself when you're practicing it. It did really cause a lot of problems for a lot of shooters, and I think that's one of the reasons they put it in there. I don't typically practice loophole shooting here at home. So again, for the purpose of shooting matches like this, I need to start doing it again. Because really getting comfortable with understanding that high over bore and figuring out how that applies to where the hole is at. And this one, another technical note here, this loophole was close enough. You didn't have to use any crazy formulas to figure out where the crossover distance was. If you start putting a loophole out downrange farther, you need to run formulas, ballistic formulas, to figure out where your crossover is so that the bullet is threading the loophole and you're still able to see your target downrange and hit your target. That would be a whole video on its own on calculating loopholes and figuring out how to actually do that. The information's out there. It's not anything that's classified. It's not anything that's top secret. It has, the formulas are very, very old math. But it is something that you need to practice if you want to get good at it. Next stage was stage 12, and this was giant staircase. The time was 120 seconds. Round count was 10. Ranges and targets were a 2-inch circle at 51 yards and a 12-inch circle at 242 yards. It was 10 rounds per impact. The equipment was any equipment the shooter used must be carried to the firing position. Start position is standing, rifle in hand, magazine in, bolt open. On the start signal, the shooter will shoot one shot at each of the two targets from near to far from the lowest step. Shooter will continue up the staircase, moving up one step and engaging the two targets from near to far with one shot. This was pretty cool. It was basically a staircase made out of railroad ties, and you had just enough room between them to get your rifle on and then have your scope see underneath the railroad ties. If you use too much of a front support, you got too high, and the next tie up obscured too much of your sight picture. Because of the way magnified optics work, if you had at least a good fraction of the lower portion of your objective looking underneath it, then you could still see a sight picture downrange. We're working in full daylight, so you don't need the full surface area of the objective to allow that light in to actually see the target. So we did get a chance to go up and climb up and down the barricade to make sure you didn't have any problems getting up and down it. They were hesitant on allowing you to move your rifle up and down the barricade. So this was fairly straightforward as far as getting on the position, getting the rifle stable and shooting. For some reason, though, I missed all of the 242-yard targets. I didn't have any problems hitting the 51-yard target. A 2-inch circle at 51 yards for a stable position really isn't that difficult. I think this is where the wind was grabbing me. I started holding left edge for the first two steps. I was missing, so I was slowing down and watching what the mirage was doing. It looked like a boil, so I started holding back to center, but I had a malfunction halfway through, and that really kind of screwed me up as well. I used the Coltac backbone for a support on it, and that allowed me just enough to, again, get enough of my scope underneath it so that I could see the targets downrange. And with the backbone in the center of the rifle, again, with the Tika balanced out as well as it was, I could just apply pressure to the center of the rifle, get it really stable, and then break the shot. So stability really wasn't an issue for me. It was just getting my wind call and then clearing the malfunctions. At this point, the Tika was having some issues with feeding. Sometimes I would go to chamber a cartridge, and instead of the bullet going into the chamber, the bullet would go straight up on the breech face. And once it did that, when I brought the bolt back, if I tried to feed another one, it would feed another cartridge and double feed and just cause all kinds of problems. Or it would just close on that one if it was still jammed in the magazine. And I would have to strip the magazine out, and I could either flick that cartridge out and just let it go, or I could push it down, feed it back, and then get the magazine back in, bolt it up, and then go on. I still haven't figured out exactly what the issue was on it. I thought I had one magazine going bad, so I threw that magazine to the back of the pile, replaced it with one of the other magazines that I brought, and the problem still persisted. So it's not something I've really been able to track down yet. I did fully clean the rifle since then, but the issue still persists. So that's going to require a little bit more evaluation on my part. But that would plague me really for the rest of the match. So again, I came off of that with 50 points. Not really feeling confident about knowing why I was missing. So that's never a good thing. Then we moved over to holdovers, and holdovers was a 122nd stage and 14 rounds. Ranges to the targets were a 1-inch target at 50 yards, 1.5-inch at 60 yards, 2-inch at 75 yards, a 2.5-inch at 90 yards, a 3-inch at 100 yards, a 3-inch at 110 yards, 4-inch at 125 yards, 4-inch at 135 yards, and a 5-inch at 150 yards. Points were 10 points per impact. Any equipment you wanted to use had to be carried to the firing position, and you started standing, rifle in hand, magazine in, bolt open. On the start signal, shooter will take a prone supported position and engage targets in order using holdovers only. Now, here's where it got really interesting. The shooting order was 50 yard, 60 yards, then 50 yards, 60 yards, 75 yards, then 60 yards, 75 yards, 90 yards, 100 yards. Then 100 yards, 110 yards, 125 yards, 135 yards, and 150 yards. If the shooter touches, not if you dial, if you touch the elevation dial after the start signal, you automatically earn a zero for the stage. So if you forget and you reached up and touched the turret to turn it, you're zeroed out. Now, some shooters were running Collis scopes that have a parallax adjustment underneath the elevation turret. The RO just requested that you tell him when you go up that you have that scope and that you need to adjust your parallax. So with the wide range of targets, you had to dial your parallax. You couldn't leave the parallax alone. You just really wouldn't be able to see your targets. So this one definitely required you to go up there with a range card, and thankfully it was a prone stage. So I pretty much wrote things out on my paper, and I could go up there and just drop it next to me. Up here, I actually had the dope written to each one of the targets. So that really wasn't that big of a deal. And then they told us you could have a teammate call for you to keep you on track. So you could have one of your other squad mates, you could give them your dope, or you could give them your sheet. What I ended up doing is I had Neil call ranges for me, and I have my dope card on the side of the gun, so I could just dial dope. So I had a plan. I went up there and decided what I was going to do, thought this was going to be fairly easy, and then really kind of screwed up on it. So again, it was 14 rounds, so 10 points per impact, so it was 140 possible. I came off of it with 80 points. So I started shooting, went through. I got to the 100-yard target, and when I missed at the 100-yard target, you had to hit to move on. The 100-yard target had some black piece of metal or plastic or something behind it. It was a really wide rectangle, so missing on the 100-yard, you got no feedback. You couldn't tell if you were just off one edge, just off the other edge, high, low, whatever, because you couldn't see anything move behind it. This thing was just absorbing the shots. So I ended up timing out on the 100-yard target, not actually getting a hit on it. So I came off with 80 points. to add insult to injury. So I did that. One of our young guns in our squad went up there and just cleaned the stage, just ran it like nothing and owned it. So she did an amazing job on it, and I didn't. So that was the no dial stage. The key to there really was not getting lost in the targets and making sure that your partner was keeping you on track. The smart thing to do was have your partner call out your dope instead of your range, so you didn't have to look at the card. All you had to do was hold the dope and then hit the target. So that was the smart way to do it. I prefer to look at my card because that's already what I had programmed in my brain, but it just hitting that 100-yard target didn't work out for me. The next stage was called Triple Threat, and this was stage 14, and it was a 120-second time limit, 9 rounds, and the ranges of the targets were a 50% IPSC, a 25% IPSC, and a 5% IPSC at 100 yards. The points were 10 points per impact, and the equipment was any equipment the shooter used must be carried to the firing position. Barricades were rope tied between two T-posts, a plastic sawhorse, and a cinder block. The start position was standing, rifle in hand, magazine in, and bolt open. On the start signal, the shooter will choose their first barricade to shoot from of the three barricades. The shooter will shoot the IPSC target from small to large. If the shooter misses a shot, the shooter will move to a different barricade. When the shooter hits all three IPSC targets, they will move to a different barricade. Shooter must use all the barricades before returning to their first choice barricade. So, of course, you had the cinder block there. Cinder block was top choice for everybody because you get the gun on it. It's pretty much a supported prone position. You're good to go. The sawhorse tended to be the second choice for most shooters. Because again, the sawhorse was a fairly solid position. The rope was actually a ratchet strap between two posts, and it had a good deal of bow in it, and then it had part of the ratchet strap came down at an angle and was tied to the bottom of one of the posts. What that kind of gave you is when you dropped a game changer across it, the game changer sat on the top, and then it came down and kind of grabbed that part that was going down at an angle. So depending upon where you put it on there, it could grab that bottom strap and give you a little bit more stability than if you were just dropping the fore end on the strap alone. I didn't even think about it for some reason until I watched another shooter go up there and do it after I had shot. The most stable position for that is just to run the game changer all the way over against the post and then drive the rifle against the post. So then you're using the post for stability. You don't even have to worry about the sway on the rope. So that was the preferred way to run the rope. I came off this with 60 points out of 90 possible. I used the game changer and I used a pump pillow as my rear support just to fill in any gaps in my body. I got 3 hits from the block. I got a miss on the strap and a miss on the sawhorse. Then I got a chance to go back to the block and got 3 more hits. So that was the nice thing about this is when you missed, you had to move. So if you missed quickly from the other barricade, you got to go back to the cinder block and get on the cinder block and run it again. So again, I got my shots off, but I got my hits from the cinder block. I wasn't intending to dump shots, but that's the way it worked out. If I remember right on this one too, kind of a little bit of a eye-opener was once you got on the sawhorse, depending on where you were at the sawhorse, there was a limb downrange that was hanging down that was obscuring one of the targets. I believe it was obscuring the first target. So you had to be careful where you staged on that. And I believe I actually had to move to make sure that I could clear that and see downrange. So on this, you needed to be prepared to move. As soon as you missed, you needed to move. Because again, if you missed and you took too long thinking about it, you're burning time that you could be using getting into the next position. you really didn't want to dwell on why you missed. When you broke the shot, if it was a miss, just move on. Everybody wanted to work their way back to the center block once they started missing, because again, that was the easy place to get hits. Yeah, it was a fun stage. At this point, the sun had come out. We were getting cooked pretty good. So everybody was crowding under the couple of canopies that they had out there for the ROs. But everybody was still having a great time. Things were still moving smoothly, and we were getting through pretty quickly. Then we moved over to stage 15, which is the Yeti Mike Mover. This was 120-second time limit, 10-round count. The targets are large and small Yeti targets on a DM mover at 124 yards. The points were 10 points per impact, and the equipment is any equipment the shooter used must be carrying to the firing position. Start position was standing, rifle in hand, magazine in, bolt open. On the start signal, shooter will take a prone supported position and engage the small Yeti target. If the shooter hits the small Yeti target, the shooter will engage the large Yeti target with one round hit or miss. Shooter must hit the small Yeti to earn their shot at the large Yeti. Once the large Yeti is engaged, the shooter must return to the small Yeti and earn another shot at the large Yeti. This will continue until all 10 rounds are fired. So you started out shooting at the small target, which was underneath this mover. It was basically a bar, and then you had the small Yeti underneath, and you had the large Yeti up top. You had to hit the small guy before you could earn a shot at the big guy. Now, it wasn't confirming you got points for each one that you hit. So if you hit the little guy and you missed the big one, you still got the points for hitting the little guy. But you couldn't fire another shot at the big guy until you hit the little guy again. The mover was, it was trucking quite a bit. So I ended up with 60 points on this. If I remember right, I was the first up on this one. So I had to kind of feel out what the lead was going to be on it. I started with a 3 mil lead, which was based on a 2 mile an hour mover, and I ended with 2 mils to the leading edge. So again, 2 mils is a pretty significant space, which gave us about 1.3 miles an hour, I think. That was what we figured out on it. But the small Yeti was relatively small, so it was a pretty interesting run. You got into a rhythm after the first couple of shots, so it was pretty fun, and I didn't have much of a problem of dinging a little one and then going up and popping the top target after I got my lead dialed in. So I did miss a couple of shots, I think, because I broke the shot too late. Timing is really a huge thing with moving targets. So once you get your lead, I generally like to use the leading edge of the target. I will trap, so I'll jump ahead, I'll pause, and then when the target breaks the mark that I've decided is my lead on it, when I see that leading edge touch that mark, I'm breaking the shot. And that usually gets me where I need it to be. It's personal preference on if you lead to center or lead to leading edge. Most shooters I find like to lead to leading edge because the leading edge is the most definable portion of it. So it's easy just to anchor your eyeball on the mark on your reticle that you want to use on your horizontal stadia. And then when the target trips it, you use that as a tripwire to fire the shot. So that's my technique on it. There were some shooters that tried to track. So the two main ways to engage a mover is ambushing. So you come ahead, you stop, and you let the target move into your reticle. Or tracking, to where you try to keep your lead on the target and track it as you break the shot. I just find that ambushing is the easier way to do it. The gun is more stable when you're ambushing because you move ahead, stop the gun, you get the gun stable, and then you break the shot at the right point. Versus moving, things are jiggling. There's always friction in the setup. You either have to be swinging the butt, or you have to be twisting the bipod, or you have to be pivoting the gun on a bag. So things have to be moving underneath the gun in order to track. Ambushing, you don't need to move. You need to snap it, get it stable, and then fire the shot. So that's just my preference. If you like to track and you can make it work, then make it work. Then we moved on to our last stage, which was stage 16, and this was called Crack House. It was 120 seconds. The round count was 10 rounds. Ranges and targets were a 5-inch plate at 131 yards and a 5-inch plate at 135 yards. Points were 10 points per impact. The equipment will be provided inside the crack house. Start position is the RO Wool ground shooter's rifle inside the crack house, magazine in, bolt open. Shooter will be standing outside the crack house. On the start signal, the shooter will move into the crack house. Shooter may use any equipment provided inside the crack house. No rail-mounted equipment may be used by the shooter other than a bipod. The shooter will engage the both targets from left to right with one round hit or miss from 5 of the 9 windows inside the crack house. 2 shots from each window the shooter chooses. So, this was a small playhouse. It had 9 windows. Really only 5 were viable for shooting this. I think everyone shot through the same 5 windows. So you had a low left and right, high left and right, and a center window. There was quite a few different styles of rear bags. There was a tripod that they set right in the middle of everything. And so you had to choose what you wanted on the fly. Now they had a Weebad mini fortune cookie up there, which I pretty much, as soon as I knew I was going to use that, because taking the fortune cookie, flipping it upside down and putting it underneath the forend of the rifle, just ahead of the magwell, allows me to get really stable on wide 2x4 barricades. And this was basically a wide 2x4 barricade. The trick here was the targets, although they're almost the same ranges and almost the same sizes, you have one target over here and one target over here. So when you got in there, you had to fire at each target from the same port. You ended up having a pretty extreme swing, and you had such a far swing that you had to shimmy your body over, and then you were almost against the side of the house when you're inside this little playhouse. So there was a lot of shuffling, a lot of movement, and then you had to get the gun stable and break the shots. I really, really did horribly on this. I only got 2 hits on it. Misses were almost impossible to spot. I didn't see any wind going on out there, and it felt like my first shots were breaking high. So I don't know. We didn't check the dope on any of these. There were a lot of misses going on, but it's difficult to tell if the misses are due to the messed up shooting position that you have to get in, or if it's due to incorrect dope, or if it's due to heat or whatever. We were in the heat of the day at this point. Everything was hot. We were worn out. The guns were hot. The guns are sitting out in the sun while you're waiting. So there's a possibility that some heat was soaking in and my dope had shifted a little bit. There's also the possibility that I was just getting a horrible position and not breaking my shots cleanly. So it was interesting, though, because they had a really confined space. You had to move in the confined space. You had to thread your rifle in and out. This is one of those places where my choice to not run my suppressor was pretty good, because on the Tika, the forend comes right up to the end of the barrel. So I don't have to worry about banging the suppressor as I'm moving it around in there. And I have the shortest package I can to move in and out those ports without having to come totally out of this little playhouse and go back inside to get the rifle stable. It's a fun stage to do, because you have to think out of the box. Luckily, one of the pieces of equipment they had there was one that I'm familiar with using, so it was an easy choice for me. They had a couple other bags that I heard shooters come out and go, that wasn't a good choice. They didn't like that piece of equipment. It was too difficult to get stable. So a lot of times using and working with a wide variety of equipment so you know what works for you and what doesn't is a good thing. They had a tripod there. I have no idea why they had a tripod there. That would have been a really, really difficult thing to set up on the time limit that we were dealing with. and move for each time. A lot of guys like to use tripods for rear supports when you have situations like that, because you can put the front end on the sill, and then you can grab a hold of the buttstock and then grab a hold of the leg of the tripod, and it allows you to adjust elevation and get the rifle very, very stable. That works, but when you're in really small confines, now you got to move that tripod around. Plus, you had two or three different elevations of ports that you had to work through. So you were going to have to extend the tripod on the clock. Then you were going to work it around in there, and then you were going to have to dance around it. So, I mean, the tripod was out in my mind as soon as I saw it. And they were actually laughing because most of us, when we went in the house, just slapped the tripod and sent it flying, because it was set right where you had to go through to get into the house. So it was in the way. If I didn't knock it out of the way, I was going to be kicking it with my feet and bouncing around. So we just slapped it, got it out of the way as you went in, and grabbed your rifle and set up. So the crack house was the end. So after the crack house, everybody went and put gear up, returned back to the pavilion there at Eagle Eye, and chilled out. They had cold drinks waiting for us. They had the prize table set out. So, of course, everybody goes through and peruses the prize table. There were some really, really amazing prizes. All the sponsors really turned out well. There were several rifles, tons of optics, just tons of different gear. So there was really something for everybody. I think everyone that shot the match took a prize home. Now, for some reason, a couple of squads got backed up earlier on. So there was quite a bit of a wait until that squad got done shooting and their scores got entered. Thankfully, NRL 22 was using practice score for this. So as soon as that last squad was done, their scores were entered. They went ahead and announced that the scores were entered to go ahead and pull them up on our mobile devices, because they were immediately on the practice score site available for review. So they announced as soon as the scores were plugged in, you could review your scores. They said the scores are there. Everybody can see the scores. The arbitration period starts now. So they went ahead and tabulated the results. And while we were waiting for all that, the Eagle Eye Shooting Complex had a great buffet style meal we went through. There was brisket, there was chicken, there was corn, there was fried okra, there was all the good stuff. So it was really a great meal to have after a long day shooting, being able to sit back and relax and discuss everything. Once that was all done, they went through and announced the scores and ran the prize table. And I'm not going to make this video any longer than necessary by going through and reading all the different places. Paul Dallin did finish first place in open class. So congratulations to Paul. So he was the overall match winner. All the rest of the results can be found down in the link in the description below to the practice score page. And you can go down and you can look at everybody. Now, of course, everybody's going to know where I finished. I placed a horrible 84th out of 100 shooters. So 84th is where I finished. I made way too many mistakes, and at the end of day one, I knew I had shot my match down in flames. So I really wasn't worried about it. It was just about having a good time. Squad 7 was absolutely awesome. No one was taking anything seriously. It was just a good time to joke with all of the guys and girls in the squad. So it was a great bunch of people. And really, a good squad makes or breaks your match. If you've got a good squad, you really enjoy the match. If you've got people that are just griping and groaning and having a bad day, then it really just kind of brings everybody down. So don't underestimate selecting a good squad when you go out there. So all the guys from Missouri were absolutely great. I really enjoy shooting with them anytime I get the chance. Now, once the scores were read, the top three finishers in the classes each got trophies, really nice, big painted trophies. And then they went through and they went through each place through each class, and they did a really convoluted calculation to figure out, because obviously open class was the largest, how many shooters to call in open class before they called shooters in their place that they finished in the other classes, so that everybody kind of got to go through the prize table and pick something nice in the order that they finished. As I said, I placed 84th. I definitely don't need any more hats and stickers, but even at 84th, I ended up picking up a really nice Mora knife for camping, backpacking, whatever. So again, even where I was at, I could grab something that wasn't a hat and wasn't a sticker. Again, the overall time out there was just absolutely great. I enjoyed the whole match. There were little things here and there that could have been done to make things run smoothly, but the ROs did an excellent job. Again, they were all volunteers. Bushnell and Bagara were the title sponsors for the match, and they were absolutely amazing. They had staff on hand to help out. Voodoo, who has always been a big sponsor of NRL 22, they were out there, and they actually had factory support for Voodoo rifles. So if for some reason you need help with your rifle, then they had their gunsmith there on scene to help you out. So really nice to see that kind of support. Now we'll get to this right here. The reason that I have this rifle in front of me, this is a Bagara B14R Steel. So Bagara was one of the title sponsors for the NRL 22 championship. And we talked to them out there, and they were very quick to be able to get us the B14R rifle to be able to start a review on. And again, it is topped with a Bushnell Forge right now. This is a scope that you saw on the Tika for quite a bit. So Bushnell, again, was also a title sponsor, and all of the ROs got a nice set of Bushnell 15 power binoculars that they were using for spotting and a tripod to go with it. And those were theirs to keep and to take home. So really, really awesome to see that they supplied all that gear. Both Bagara, Bushnell, and Voodoo, and quite a few others had some really fantastic prizes laid out on the prize table. So it was a great time. Sponsors really kicked in, and the sponsors really helped this thing go forward. The range of rifles that you saw out there, we'll talk about that real quick. There were a lot of Bagaras, a lot of Voodoos out there, but then you saw quite a few Tikas, quite a few CZs, and quite a few Rugers, both the Ruger 10/22, the Ruger Precision Rimfire, and the Ruger American. Pretty much most of the precision-oriented gun manufacturers were represented. So there's a pretty wide variety of guns out there. Now, my view on this, after having run the Tika and run it hard over 2 days, the championship was much more difficult and much more demanding than you would with a regular NRL 22 match. So I learned a lot of things about gear setup and going forward, how I'm going to set my rifle up for that kind of match. I've got the B14R up here as an example, but a lot of this is going to apply to the Voodoo as well. Now, Voodoo is quite a bit more expensive than the B14. That's why I grabbed the B14 for this instead of the Voodoo, because a lot of the features are the same. One of the big things we'll talk about here is magazine. Now, the Bagara magazines are only 10-round magazines. The good about them is that they are large magazines. And so if you already have a precision rifle magazine pouch, it is more than likely an AICS style magazine. So these magazines will fit in that pouch. So it's very easy for me to have a Kydex or a large nylon magazine pouch on my side and to grab this magazine and get it in the gun fast. You just have to get that little tower that the rounds are in there, and the magazine slides right in and locks in pretty quickly. When you're dealing with the Tika has much smaller magazines, and you need to make sure you get them back against the trigger guard and get them fed in. Smaller magazines mean they're more difficult to fish out of a pouch. The pouch that I was using was a Coltac elastic magazine pouch that is designed for the AICS magazines, so it's a little large for the T1X magazines. So what I had to do is go in with my pincher fingers, reach in, grab it, try not to drop it, fumble it into the large mag well, and make sure I got it seated, and then feed everything in. As I mentioned, I was having feed problems. When we talk about this rifle here, and again, the Voodoo as well, it is a control round feed rifle. So this little tower places the bullet right behind the chamber, just slightly lower. And as soon as you hit it with the bolt, the cartridge pops up and is held by the bolt face and runs straight into the chamber. So there is a minimum of things to go wrong with feeding issues. So large magazines, easy to get a hold of, easy to get in the gun, and straight line feeding into the chamber. That's really nice. The other thing is that you've got a really large bolt handle that is easy to get a hold of. Now, I ran the Stark bolt handle on the T1X. So that is a good thing. Advantage to the T1X is a short bolt throw, short bolt lift. So it's only a 60 degree lift, whereas both the B14 and the Voodoo is a 90 degree bolt lift. So you do have a little bit more of a bolt lift there. Gun setup, I'm still on the fence on if going with the heavier Tikka was the best way to go. I need to go out and set up some drills and run with the heavier gun and run with the lighter weight gun and see which one I'm really quicker at. The advantage is moving a lighter weight gun is quicker. There's really no question about that. Picking it up, moving it through ports, slinging it around, lighter weight gun moves quicker, but the heavier gun settles quicker. So that extra mass, as soon as I get dropped in there and apply a little bit of pressure to it, the gun settles down and is ready to shoot. So it's a matter of, is the time that it takes to settle the lighter gun offset by the speed with which I can move the lighter gun? So that is something that we are going to have to see going forward. These heavier rifles, though, as opposed to a really light 10/22 or a light Ruger American, they just feel better to me as a shooter. They feel more like a solid, real rifle. Not like a kid's toy. So I like the larger, heavier feel. Shorter barrels, I'm a big believer in a 16-inch barrel for these kind of matches. Even with the ranges that we're shooting to, a 16-inch barrel, I think, would really help with getting in and out and through barricades. I was comfortable with my choice not to run a suppressor on the gun. I really like shooting with a suppressor. I'll continue to shoot a suppressor at the local matches, but it was one less thing to worry about. It was less mirage in front of the gun when things started to heat up. It was less length to work with when you're in things like that crack house where you've got to move in and out of tight ports and a tight distance to move. So we will be doing a series not too distant in the future, not a Mail Call Mondays thing. This will be totally separate from that. And we are going to talk about building up a 22 for long range. And we are going to go from gun setup, data gathering, dope gathering, and then out to the range to shooting out to 400 yards. So if that's something you guys are interested in, make sure you drop a comment down below and make sure you subscribe to the channel, and that way you can get notified when we release that. And I think that's going to do it for this video. I really want to thank the guys at NRL 22 and the guys at the Eagle Eye Shooting Complex. And of course, as always, all the ROs that make it possible. You really can't shoot a match without ROs. So they're out there cooking in the sun. They're out there having to deal with all the same things the shooters are dealing with. But they're just doing it to help support the shooting sports. So again, thank you very much for all the ROs that were out there. Every single one of you did an awesome job. And hopefully I got to thank you in person while we were at the stages. But if I failed to, I apologize for that. And I'll tell you thank you now. So that's going to do it for this Mail Call Mondays. And that's going to do it for the wrap-up of the National Rifle League Championship. in Tennessee at the Eagle Eye Shooting Complex. If you guys have any questions or comments over anything I've covered on this video, please leave it in the comment section down below or send it to us on Facebook or Twitter. If you like the video, please make sure you like, share, and subscribe, and click that little bell icon so you get notified when we release new content. YouTube likes to bury gun videos at the bottom, so clicking notifications on will help you know when we send out videos. And if you want to help support the content that you know and love, please check us out over on Patreon. And for those of you guys that are sick of 22 content, don't worry, we've got some centerfire content that is coming up very soon. Until next time, get out and shoot.